Well, good evening once again. Very thankful for the opportunity to spend some time with you talking about some things that are so vital to us. I'd like to begin tonight in Acts, the 17th chapter. Acts chapter 17, as we think about a statement made that's pretty well known to most of us, I think, and in verse 11, which simply says that those in Berea were more noble-minded than those in Thessalonica, for they received the word with great eagerness, examining the scriptures daily to see whether these things were so. And we find differing attitudes in Acts, the 17th chapter. At the beginning of the chapter, there are the staunch Jews who are unwilling to listen to anything that they had already heard. They accuse Paul and his companions of upsetting the world in verse 6. And so there were some who were persuaded by the truth, but many were not. Paul had reason from the scriptures, explaining and giving evidence about Jesus. At the end of Acts 17, we find another attitude, marked by a desire to hear only new things, in verse 21. So you have, on the one hand, those who only wanted to hear what they've already heard before. They didn't want to hear anything new. On the other hand, you have those who only want to hear new things. And of course, they're willing to let Paul speak, and the reaction to the resurrection that he taught there was mixed. So some want to hear only what they've only heard. Some want to hear only new things. And we find here in verse 11 a better, more honorable attitude exemplified. We read about the Bereans, noble, eager, and willing to examine what they heard to make sure that what was being taught was true. And the chapter shows that it really doesn't matter how old something is to us or how new something is to our ears. What matters is whether or not it's the truth. We don't seek the old because it's old, or we don't seek the new because it's new. We seek the truth because it's right. And so finding truth is rewarding in and of itself. And the importance of truth to the child of God should be pretty self-evident. It's highlighted in many passages, but recall, for example, John 8, verse 32, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free," talking about being free from sin. In Ephesians 4, 20 and 21, Paul says, "You did not learn Christ in this way, if indeed you've heard him and have been taught in him, just as truth is in Jesus." Or John 1 and verse 14, "The Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we saw his glory, glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." Or in John 14, 6, Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me." The question is, how do we determine truth? To determine is to decide or conclude that something is true, something is right. But it also kind of carries the meaning of adding different characterizations of something. In other words, you're differentiating between ideas. We understand that there are boundaries to what we would consider to be the truth, rather than just accepting anything and everything. We have the warning in 1 John chapter 4 and verse 1, "Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they're from God, because many false prophets have gone out into the world." Just because somebody says something doesn't mean it's true. We're not to be gullible. A few years ago, 2016, Time Magazine Online had, every year they have a word of the year, Oxford's word of the year. And in 2016, that word of the year was post-truth. Now let that sink in for just a minute. Post-truth. According to the article, post-truth, quote, "describes a situation in which feelings trump facts," unquote. It's called an apt choice for countries like America and Britain, where people live through divisive populist upheavals that often seem to prize passion above all else, including facts. So the definition they give to the word post-truth is relating to or denoting circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal belief. Now, they say that the word post-truth dates back to 1992, but Oxford, it says, saw its usage explode by 2,000% in 2016. And they're applying that primarily to the political climate of our age, and then they suggest, quote, "it may become the defining word of our time." Now, that was initially noticed, again, within a more political context, but it's not difficult to see how that term broadly fits the way our culture has been moving for quite some time. We're past truth. Truth doesn't mean anything anymore. And this is the way people think about religion as well. So the terminology may be shifting somewhat, but the problem presented here really is nothing new. The term that had been used up until that time more is the term, sometimes you might hear the word postmodernism. And it's a term that describes a shift in thinking in which, first, people create their own truth. Truth is not objective. Truth is what you want to make it. Does that sound familiar? And where they say objective facts are met with suspicion. If somebody says something is actually true objectively, well, I don't know about that. Everything, including truth, is relative, and because of that, tolerance must be applied to all unless it's people who believe that there is objective truth to which we're all amenable. Post-truth and postmodernism really are essentially the same. Truth is almost seen as an outdated notion. People don't know that they can call anything true anymore. All they know is how they feel. And there was a time when we could reasonably expect to have a common agreement to the idea that truth was discoverable. You can actually think that there is a truth, and you might argue about what that truth is, but now many people don't even agree that there is such a thing as truth at all. Post-truth advocates have outgrown the idea of truth because intuition tells us more than evidence does. We just need to go with our feelings and forget about trying to convince others that there's objective truth based on real facts that ought to be persuasive. Does any of this sound familiar? This is the way our culture has been going for some time. So in this post-truth era, traditional morals and viewpoints are seen as oppressive. Advocates may think that they're spiritual and they wouldn't necessarily say it's wrong to be religious, but the key is that you just have to keep your religious and moral views to yourself because they're just your subjective preferences. Why? Well, because if you present your views as absolute truth, then you're going to oppress those who feel differently. And of course, one of the worst things we can do today is hurt someone's feelings, regardless of how wrong-headed those feelings may be. There's little value given to the idea that our feelings might need to be challenged and they might need to change because they might be wrong. So we can see why this post-truth concept is going to be at odds with biblical Christianity. God is the ground and source of truth. And all the works of God's hands, according to Psalm 111:7, are truth and justice. The truth of the Lord is everlasting, Psalm 117 and verse 2 says. The fundamental nature of truth is at stake. When Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, that can only be meaningful if that truth is objective and equally applies to everybody. Truth that is not objective is really not truth, and it cannot set anybody free. So post-truth is an idea that is anti-biblical, anti-God, and anti-Christ as it can be. But Christians can easily fall prey to that post-truth kind of trap if we don't keep our guard up. We can fall prey to the notions that our feelings matter more than the facts, more than truth itself. And people treat religion as if it's meant to be something that is at their whim, at their beck and call, that God is just supposed to rubber stamp whatever we feel is best at the time. This can be most egregious, for under the guise of serving God, we may be creating idols out of our own feelings. And we need to really be careful about that. Our question here is, how do we understand truth when we hear it? So not only do we need to know the truth, we need to know, really be aware of the nature of truth in order to determine whether truth is what we're actually seeing or hearing. In other words, determining truth requires determining some fundamental things about truth, truth about truth, if you will. And I want to consider a few of those things tonight. First of all, truth is rooted in reality. Knowledge requires, if I'm going to say I know anything, it requires that what I'm saying I know be real and it be truth. Because it implicitly claims that what is known is the truth. Otherwise, knowledge means nothing and the claim is pretty hollow. If what is known is not truth, then saying I know something but it's not true would make no rational sense. So truth and reality are tied together here. Because if something's not real, it can be neither truth nor known in any actual sense. We may even hear somebody say today, well, there is no truth. No such thing as truth. To which we simply ask, is that true? Do you know that to be true? And you know, it's one of those things where it's a self-defeating statement, turns on itself. Somebody says, there's no truth, just ask him, is that true? Is that the truth? Because it yields confusion, it yields hypocrisy, because if there is no truth is true, then it's false. But if it's not true, then it's false. Either way, it's false. It makes no rational sense to say there's no such thing as truth. Do you realize that every claim we make is a truth claim? And to say there is no truth is itself a truth claim about truth. But that means it's irrational. If we're going to know that something is the truth, we need to know that it's real. There's no sense, again, in talking about truth unless what we're discussing is grounded in reality. Let me give some example here. In discussing morality, there are some atheists who argue that moral values are illusory rather than real. They argue that morals have evolved simply to help us survive, but they're not actual, they're not objective. And that makes any discussion of truth relative to moral values meaningless. Atheist Michael Ruse, for example, wrote this. He says, considered as a rationally justifiable set of claims about an objective something, it, ethics, is illusory. I appreciate that when somebody says, love thy neighbor as thyself, they think they're referring above and beyond themselves. Nevertheless, to a Darwinian evolutionist, it can be seen that such reference is truly without foundation. Morality is just an aid to survival, and reproduction has no it's an aid to survival and reproduction has no being or meaning beyond this or without this. He says morality is an ephemeral product, that is a temporary idea of the evolutionary process, just as are other adaptations. It has no existence or being beyond this, and any deeper meaning is illusory. So your morals are just an illusion foisted upon you by the processes of naturalistic Darwinian evolution. That's what he's saying. It's not really real. They're not based on objective reality. And so any discussion we're going to have about morals is really based upon just what you feel at the time. That's it. Richard Dawkins, well-known atheist, took a similar position when he wrote, quote, the universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference. Now, he uses worldview language there, that term at bottom. Is worldview language. That's foundational language right there. And he's saying, at bottom, foundationally, there's no design, there's no purpose, there's no evil, there's no good, only pitiless indifference. But you see, if evil is not real, then it cannot be true that evil is bad. For then we're making a nonsensical statement that something that does not exist is bad. The same holds for truth. If it's not real, then talking about it becomes pretty pointless. So my point is that reality is fundamental to understanding and determining truth. When Jesus said, I am the truth, he was speaking of what is actual, what is real. He was not teaching it's just some imaginary idea there that doesn't really mean anything and it's just subjective. He not only teaches truth, he is truth. If his identity is not rooted in who he really is, his reality, then teaching that he is the truth would make no sense. But if he is who he claimed to be, then he is the only truth that can save us, and that is reality. But tied to that, truth is objective. You know, many today are fond of arguing that truth is subjective. The difference is, subjective means it's just coming from within you. It's what I feel. Objective means it's outside of yourself. Postmodern philosophy sees truth as something we create in ourselves. We create our own reality. We create our own truth, not something that is objectively true. But if truth is real, then it must also be objective. That is, it stands outside of ourselves, and it's true whether we accept it or not, whether we believe it or not. I can't say, well, God exists only if I believe in him. God exists whether I believe in him or not is irrelevant to whether or not he actually exists. He's there whether I accept that or not. That would be truth. So if truth is real, it has to be outside of me. It stands outside of ourselves. And how we feel about that doesn't change the truth. So the objective nature of truth, I think we can see, for example, in Paul's statement to the Galatians. In Galatians 1 and verse 8, Galatians 1 and verse 8, Paul writes that even if we or an angel from heaven should preach to you a gospel contrary to what we've preached to you, he's to be accursed. As we've said before, so I say again, if any man is preaching to you a gospel contrary to what you received, he is to be accursed. He's talking about an objective reality, a truth about God, a truth about the message that God gives us. And if he preaches something contrary to that, it says he's to be accursed. But in that passage, there's an objective standard to which we may appeal. The gospel that has been preached is something that we can look at, appeal to, and say, this is true. This is the reality that we're dealing with here. If something runs contrary to that, if something runs contrary to what has been revealed, he says, then it's to be accursed. Sometimes people will claim to have seen an angel or some kind of vision telling them what to do or believe. And of course, that's never verifiable. There's no way to cross-check what they claim. But Paul's point here would apply. I've talked to people like this before, and I just say, well, okay, I wasn't there, I didn't see it, but what I can do is ask you this question. Was it the truth? Did it conform to the message that was revealed? If not, let it be accursed. That's the point Paul makes there. Let it be accursed. So, the problem is that feelings can't be challenged. You can't challenge somebody's feelings, can you? I mean, if I were to say to you, I feel really good right now. You can't say, oh, no, you don't. Or if I said, you know, my feeling about ice cream is I prefer chocolate over mint. Oh, no, you don't. You can't challenge that kind of statement, can you? Because they're feeling-based, they're preference-based. You can deal with objective statements, though, and that's what we're talking about. So there's a real danger of putting feelings over truth. Now, feelings, don't get me wrong, feelings are a vital part of who we are. God gave them to us. We all have them. We nurture them. None of us wants to have our feelings hurt or injured in any way. But there's a great danger here. If feelings have a proper place, but we need to be aware that sometimes, if we're not careful, those feelings try to win out over the facts. The facts of sin do not change just because our feelings about those sins might change. We're always in danger of falling deeper into sin based on how we feel at the time. Well, at the time, I feel this way. And then once we begin to allow those feelings to hold sway, we begin to rationalize the way we look at sin. Well, it's not that bad, is it? We may think. You know, the old song expresses the problem. If loving you is wrong, I don't want to be right. But that's exactly the danger expressed in passages like James 1, 14 and 15. James 1, 14 and 15, each one is tempted when he's carried away and enticed by his own lust. Then when lust is conceived, it gives birth to sin, and when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. So being carried away by lust is not substantively different from my feelings carrying me away. The feelings, the desires win out over the objective knowledge of the truth that the action is sinful. I might know intellectually that something is wrong, but my feelings take over and I think, well, I can do that anyway because I feel this way at the time. My feelings deceive me then, and I'm carried away by those desires. Feelings end up winning the day. But need to understand that the action is still sinful, regardless of how we feel about that. That's true with our own personal lives regarding the temptations and sins that face us. It's also true in how we rationalize sins on behalf of others. Have you paid attention to discussions over matters like gay marriage or transgenderism or abortion? You may have noticed that the leading factor in all those issues is how people feel. It's what I feel. It's what I like. It's what makes me happy. There's little appeal to objective facts. There's no real argument being made. when objective facts are brought up, those facts are often shot down with how we feel. Doesn't matter what biology shows. If you feel a certain way, you should go with it. Yet when feelings take the lead, a lot of other problems come with that. Because through our feelings, we express anger and bitterness and vitriol. It's feelings being expressed that cause others to bully and push and insult and kill. It's feelings that cause us to avoid the calm reflection in favor of irrational outbursts. And that's expressly stated to be foolish in Scripture. Listen to the wise man in Proverbs 12 and verse 15. Proverbs 12 and verse 15. The way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but a wise man is he who listens to counsel. A fool's anger is known at once, but a prudent man conceals dishonor. He who speaks truth tells what is right, but a false witness deceit. There is one who speaks rashly like the thrusts of a sword, but the tongue of the wise brings healing. Then in Proverbs 14 and verse 29, Proverbs 14 and verse 29, he who is slow to anger has great understanding, but he who is quick-tempered exalts folly. A tranquil heart is life to the bones, but passion is rottenness to the bones. Proverbs 15 and verse 18, a hot-tempered man stirs up strife, but the slow to anger calms a dispute. The Lord tells us unquestionably to take control of your feelings. And when you have passages in the New Testament that tell us put away anger, for example, put away all anger and malice, put away bitterness, he's telling us get hold of your feelings and take control. And understand that no matter how you feel, outbursts of anger and wrath and that kind of thing is not excusable just because of how you feel. The same would be true of any of those issues we've talked about. The conundrum of our culture is that on the one hand, we're supposed to go with our feelings. But on the other hand, it's those feelings that lead to the very problems of abuse and bullying that our culture is so desperately trying to fight. With one hand, we feed the beast. With the other hand, we try to kill the same beast even while we're feeding it. A look at social media, I think, is sufficient to see that. Post-truth views will always fail because they appeal to the very thing they deny. Again, there is no truth is a truth claim about truth. Self-defeating. You ought to go with your feelings is a moral ought statement that's also based on a subtle objective truth claim. Feelings are more important than facts is what they're trying to say. C.S. Lewis wrote, when you're arguing against him, God, you're arguing against the very power that makes you able to argue at all. It's like cutting off the branch you're sitting on. Feelings are dangerous when we allow them to hold more power than truth. But there's more for us to think about here. Truth is discoverable. Truth can be investigated. Truth can be found. That's the nature of it. Because it's objective, you can discover the same truth that I can discover. Because it's outside of both of us. So it's something that can be searched for. It's something that can be studied. It's something that can be known. Again, they search the Scriptures daily to see whether these things were true. God made us with minds that can reason and think and discover and learn. We're not mere robots. We have been made with the need to reason things out. And as we grow in our maturity and in our thinking, we ought to be able to discern good and evil. Hebrews 5 and verse 14 makes that point. We need to discern between good and evil. That means our minds are able to look at something and say, this is right, this is wrong. Based upon the principles that God gives us in Scripture, we can make a determination. Ought I to be engaging in that activity? Should I stay away from this? And the principles can teach me, and I can discern the difference between right and wrong. The truth can be investigated then. It's no surprise, for that fits the nature of the gospel and the need to be informed. Listen again to what Luke says as he begins his gospel with that very purpose. Luke chapter 1 and verse 1. Listen to how Luke begins this gospel. Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile an account of the things accomplished among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and servants of the word, it seemed fitting for me as well, having investigated everything carefully from the beginning, to write it out in consecutive order, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the exact truth about the things you have been taught. Luke says, I have investigated this. I have spoken with eyewitnesses. I want you to know the exact truth about the things that have been taught. Again, that's not a once upon a time fairy tale beginning. Like we said the other day, you might not like what Luke says. You may think Luke is wrong, but you can't say Luke didn't have a purpose in mind of telling the truth, because that's what he said explicitly was his purpose, and he did it with investigation. He did it in a way that basically says, you can discover this. If we desire to know truth, we will search for it, and we can discover it. And so truth is attainable. Again, we understand that truth can be truth that is undiscoverable to us. There are aspects of God and His knowledge, we talked about this last night, aspects of that that we cannot attain. There are true things about God that we'll never fully understand. Ephesians 3:20 says God is able to do far more abundantly beyond anything we can ask or think. But that's not to be understood to mean that no truth can be attained. What we're discussing here is within our reach. Our search will not be in vain, because it will be a valuable, vital part of who we are. And that also would imply that truth is understandable. It's unattainable. It's understandable. We can know it. We can be persuaded by it. We can submit to it. John 8:31 says that Jesus was saying to those Jews who had believed him, if you continue in my word, you are disciples of mine, truly disciples of mine, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free. And in that context, again, truth makes us free from sin. Discovering truth will be more valuable and more lasting than anything else we seek to do. Because again, to find truth is ultimately to find Jesus, because he is the truth. But it's Jesus who said, keep on knocking, keep on asking, keep on seeking, and you'll find. The door will be opened. It'll be there. You'll find it, but you've got to want to do that. I've had people talk to me and say, you know, they're losing their faith, or they're doubting or whatever, and they're not really putting much effort forth to understand more truth. They're not really looking at it. Someone says, what can I do to build up my faith? I ask you, how much are you reading your Bible? How much are you looking into it? How much are you seeking it out? We have to be proactive in maintaining our faith. But it's attainable. It's doable. We have to want it. The truth is also immutable. What that means is it doesn't change over time. The nature of objective truth does not change over time. There can be things that are relatively true. So I can say, for example, it is true for me that I like chocolate ice cream better than mint. Now you might say, well, I like vanilla better. Okay, that's your preference. I can't really argue with that. And we would all recognize that it would be silly to sit there and argue over what the best flavor is, because that's a subjective preference. It's true for me that it's this way, and it's true for you that it's that way. But this is not really what we're talking about tonight. We're not talking about fashions and foods and general preferences. We're talking about truth with a capital T. True truth, as some have said. Personal preferences are different from objective standards. Objective standards remain objective whether or not we like them, whether or not we've changed personal preferences or not. Therefore, if what we're considering is personable or changeable, then it's not truth with a capital T. We're trying to talk about true truth. For example, it is objectively true that murder is immoral. That doesn't change over time. We shouldn't expect that, you know, 200 years from now, murder's going to be okay. Everybody's going to be okay with it. It is objectively true that assaulting others is wrong. Racism is objectively evil because it violates the dignity of humanity created in God's image. These types of matters are true because they reflect the reality of God Himself, and God doesn't change. So speaking in a context of judgment, God's faithfulness, Malachi 3 and verse 6, God declared, I, the Lord, do not change. God is faithful. His declared truth will match His nature. So, for example, when God declared His oath to Abraham, Hebrews chapter 6, verses 15 through 18 tells us, it was as good as done. He could swear by no one greater, so He swore by Himself. God's word is sure. God's word is faithful. It will always be true, because it's impossible for God to lie, and His purpose is unchangeable. Likewise, again, Jesus saying, I am the truth, does not change. Hebrews 13 and in verse 8 tells us that He is unchangeable. He is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Since truth is based on God's immutable character, then what is changeable and contrary to God's nature will not be the truth we're looking at tonight. But truth is also universal. Personal preferences are local. They're in me, right? This is my preference. Personal preferences are limited. But truth, true truth, is universal in nature. Truth is true regardless of who you are, where you are, when you are. God's will is universal. If He desires all men to come to the knowledge of the truth and be saved, 1 Timothy 2 and verse 4, that same truth about sin and salvation applies to everyone, regardless of who they are or when they are. He's not teaching that out of only one little group or narrow nation, Jesus came to die only for them and nobody else. That's not what the Bible teaches us. Jesus came into this world to die as a propitiation for all the world, 1 John 2 and verse 2 tells us. And that need for salvation is universal because sin is universal. And so the salvation offered through Jesus Christ is as universal as God's expressed will. And moral truth is universal. That which is good or evil is equally applicable across time and place. Murder is always wrong, regardless of who we are or where we are. Now, I realize when you talk about morality, someone might say, but different cultures have different moral practices, and that's the case. There is what we would just call a moral ought. Everybody has a line that you don't cross. You think about that? Everybody has a line that you don't cross. So even the one who said, as we quoted earlier tonight, morals are illusory, that man will still have a line that you don't cross. And I think it's interesting to watch our world today because you're looking at people giving lines and saying, you can't cross this line. You can't be engaged in harassment. You can't do this. You can't do that. There's a line you don't cross. My question is, where do those morals come from? And who gets to determine that? They are universal and they are objective over time. Love as a virtue is always right everywhere and for everyone because God is love. You get the idea. The truth is foundational. Truth must be at the baseline of a worldview if that worldview is going to be meaningful at all. We've been trying to stress that this week. If what is at the bottom of the worldview is false, like Dawkins said, at bottom there's no good, no evil. There's no right or wrong. It's just, you know, pitiless indifference. If that's the case, then how viable of a worldview can that really be? It can't stand as a viable option by which we ought to be living our lives. And that requires that truth be self-consistent. If we believe that something is self-contradictory, then we can say, well, that's not going to be the truth. So a worldview based upon a no-truth foundation will always fail. The only foundation that can stand ultimately will be based in truth. And again, that's highlighted by Jesus at the end of the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 7. Notice the foundational language here. We teach this to our kids, but this is just as important for all of us as adults. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and acts on them may be compared to a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and slammed against that house, yet it did not fall, for it had been founded on the rock. Everyone who hears these words of mine and does not act on them will be like the foolish man who built his house on the sand. The rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and slammed against that house, and it fell, and great was its fall. What's the difference between the two? One is founded on the rock, one is on the sand. One is going to stand the test of time, the other will not. And really what he's saying is you want to have your foundation on the rock, you need to hear Jesus and listen to him because he's the truth. I want to connect all of this back to our faith. We began this week by talking about faith and what that is. But faith can keep our feelings in check. Again, I'm not denying the need to have feelings. We have feelings. We recognize that's a normal thing. The question is, how can we keep them in check? How can we keep them from taking the lead over truth? 1 John chapter 5 says in verse 1, "Whoever believes that Jesus is the Christ is born of God, and whoever loves the Father loves the child born of him. By this we know that we love the children of God when we love God and observe his commandments. For this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not burdensome. Whatever is born of God overcomes the world, and this is the victory that has overcome the world, our faith." Well, again, some have the mistaken notion that faith is just feelings without evidence, in spite of evidence. It's just what you kind of feel and what you prefer and what you like. That's what some think about that. But that couldn't be further from the truth about faith. Faith is a trust that is built upon facts. Faith is a demonstration of a conviction in the reality and the truth of what we can't ultimately see right now. We all have faith in something. We all have a foundation that we build on, even though we don't necessarily see it. Faith does direct our feelings, but biblical faith should never be disconnected from truth. Truth is first. Truth is primary. Truth supersedes and takes precedence over feelings. Yet faith can latch onto that truth and redirect our feelings in a way that keeps them in check and honors those feelings appropriately. That also means that faith can act when our feelings would take us in another direction. For example, I may feel angry and hurt about something. And in my anger, I may be tempted to lash out in a fit that will be destructive to others and to myself. Faith, however, can make me pause and think it through. Faith can say, this is a work of the flesh. I want to please God. I need to love others. I'm going to act appropriately and not act on these destructive feelings. It causes us to stop and take notice. Because of trust in God and His Word, we can stave off the destructive circumstances that may come through the expression of those unchecked feelings. In other words, here's what faith does. Faith redirects our minds to God and His Word so that we'll trust who God is and what He said. Am I going to really trust Him in this issue or not? We're then reminded of our relationship to both God and others. Remember, the greatest command is what? Love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. And the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. If I can keep those in front of me all the time, even when my feelings are trying to lead me in a different direction, I can redirect back to that in faith and trust that God knows what He's talking about. We can recall then how we ought to be thinking and acting. You remember when Jesus was tempted, Matthew 4, Luke 4, the first thing he always appealed to in those temptations was what? It is written. It is written. It is written. He could have acted out in feelings. I imagine he really was hungry. I imagine there was a temptation there, but it is written. Here's a standard. Here's truth. I'm going to act according to the truth, not according to a feeling. Then we can choose to act in a godly way. Even if our feelings aren't there at the moment, we can choose to act in a godly way. It's like the way we think about love today. You realize that the Bible doesn't talk about love as a feeling. It talks about it as an action. Because God is love. When we say we love something today, we usually are talking about our feelings. I'm in love. We use the word love in so many ways. I love peanut butter. I love my dog. I love my wife. You know, is there a difference in the way we talk about these things? Well, you hope so. But when we talk about that, and then later we say, well, I'm falling out of love or something along, what we're talking about are our feelings. I may not have as strong of feelings one day as I do another, but here's the one thing I can do. I can choose to love. I can choose to act in a way that is consistent with love, and whether I'm feeling it that day or not is irrelevant because I can choose to love. I can choose to do the right thing, and the feelings will come around. You can keep your feelings in check. You can appropriately honor them. You can bring them back into line, but you always choose to do the right thing. Act on faith. And we can overcome the problems that can arise through our feelings. But that will take time, and it will take practice. And we need time because we need to be imbibing God's Word, developing a spiritual mindset. If you've been raised up with Christ, keep seeking the things that are above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Set your mind on things above, not on things of this earth. Colossians 3, 1 and 2 says. And then he goes on and says in verses 3 and 4, you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is our life, is revealed, you will be revealed with him in glory. So post-truth may be one of those words that, at least in one year, was the word of the year, and it may be the word that kind of defines our culture today. But truth will always be the word for the child of God. The nature of truth that is objective and real and applies equally to everyone. To determine truth, we must determine characteristics about the fundamental nature of truth. This is what we've been trying to do here. We know that we're dealing with something that is real. We're dealing with something that is objective. It's discoverable, attainable, immutable, and universal, and foundational to other principles that help us make up a viable worldview. The question now is, does our search merely validate what we already think, like the Jews in Thessalonica in Acts 17:5? Or to get excited over hearing a bunch of new things, like the Athenians in Acts 17:21? Or to actually find the truth, like the Bereans in Acts 17 and verse 11? May God help us to be noble-minded. We're going to sing a song in just a moment if we'll prepare to do that. Let's apply this lesson to our own salvation. How do you know you're saved? Now you might say, because I feel it. But there's people who are going to feel saved who are not. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven. Many people feel it, but feelings are not the guiding factor in how we're saved. Truth is the guiding factor in how we're saved. I do that, my feelings will come around because I realize this is the will of God. Maybe tonight you need to be baptized into Christ. We don't offer that as something we just feel this is the right thing to do. This is what Scripture teaches. Or if you need the prayers of this congregation, if you need our help, let somebody here know, come forward, do whatever needs to be done. But please do not walk out of this building tonight uncertain of where you stand before God. Be reconciled to Him. Let's stand and sing.